Okay, the Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. My vice chair's on his, there he is. Okay, we were waiting. There he is, he's right here. Our full committee is present. Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Costello, Senator Wilikowski. It's a great day. We're hearing some different ideas about treatment, medication-assisted treatment. And so first up, we have Mark Bozen, okay, and Paula Kolstgott, if they could come forward. Just put your name on the record for us and then go ahead and...
My name is Mark Bozen. I'm a pharmacist and an attorney, and I work for Alkermes, the manufacturer of Vivitrol.
And I'm Paula Kolstgott. I'm a physician here in Anchorage who currently works with Providence Breakthrough in the methadone clinic and urgent care, and my specialty is internal medicine, and I'm board certified in addiction medicine.
Excellent. And do you prefer questions during your presentation or at the end?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
To us, whatever the chair's preference would be. We've also brought with us four other testifiers, and I don't know if it's appropriate for them to introduce themselves now or as we go.
Why don't we do it as we go?
Okay.
And my preference is that members ask questions as they
That's fine with
come
us.
To them. Okay.
Okay.
Great.
All right. I'll begin. Where we started this, if I'm sorry, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Where we started this conversation a while back was trying to educate members of the legislature on different treatment opportunities that are highly underutilized, frankly, but also I wanted an opportunity to talk about medication-assisted treatment in general for those suffering with alcoholism and opiate dependency, and that's why I've brought a number of panelists who are Alaskan healthcare providers, and actually the final witness today will be the mother of someone who's in recovery who's been successfully treated, and I think that's a very compelling story. And so we'll go through and we'll make a brief presentation. I work for the company that makes Vivitrol. Vivitrol is one of the tools in the toolbox for medication-assisted treatment for both alcoholism and people suffering with opiate dependency. And when I say opiate dependency, that means everything from prescription opiates that are diverted and abused, as well as street drugs like heroin that are in that same classification. Opiates are all derivatives of morphine derived from the poppy plant. And as we all know, it's a very prevalent problem. The scope of the problem in the United States, and each state has its share. Alaska, at many times, is a disproportionate share of people who suffer with addictions. But nationally, nearly 8 million people, 8 million Americans suffer with alcoholism. And according to the Alaska State Troopers report that comes out every year, they cite alcohol as the drug of choice, the most prominent addictive substance that they run into here in this state. Opiate use is a growing problem too. It's
Can you
one
define
that's
an opiate as well, just for
sure.
The people listening out there.
It's a good question.
You tend to
opiates are generally pain relieving medications.
Comes from the poppy seed.
So medications that people recognize of Vicodin, Percocet, morphine, Dilaudid. Those are all opiate-derived pain medications. Heroin is probably the most widely recognized street version of an opiate medication. It's a very potent opiate medication.
And how are Alaskans, Americans, gaining access to these drugs?
There are a number of pathways. One of the most common pathway that we think of are people who are treated with legitimate pain. Addiction is a brain disease, and so we're not often able to identify an addict before they're exposed to a substance. And one of the more prominent ways we understand people get in trouble with opiate medications is they have an injury, a trauma, they're treated appropriately for their acute injury, but the dopamine surge in their brain that's associated with the high or the pleasurable feeling that comes with taking opiates is one that they develop a physical dependence to. And the common pathway that I hear and the clinicians here will also discuss is the person who's on pain medication for either an acute or a chronic condition needs more and more and more, continues to use. At some point, it's inappropriate. They're cut off. They don't seek appropriate treatment. The pharmacy, the physician is unwilling to prescribe more. They're not exposed to proper treatment, and then they'll go into the street and seek medications that have been diverted, people who've got them at the pharmacy but are selling them to people who are on the street. Or heroin is something that's also very commonly found. It's a very inexpensive medication to find, recreational medication to find. And so people who can't afford prescription medications on the street sometimes will turn to diverted heroin because it's sometimes less expensive than brand name medication that have made it into the streets.
Senator Machicki.
Now, one is a technical comment. Sometimes there's a lot of light background slides. We may reduce
Could
the lighting.
The light up, Amy?
And then the second one is a is.
Thank you, Amy.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Machicki.
Second one is why did heroin? I mean, clearly the price of heroin coming down has exacerbated the problem in Alaska.
Yeah.
Why did the price of heroin come down? And why is it so incredibly affordable these days?
It's a good question. Market demand, I think, is something that it's a fairly prevalent drug to find. So it's in high supply, and so there's lots of competition, if you will, on the street for people to sell it. And it's not a very expensive drug to manufacture in a clandestine manufacturing facility. You don't have FDA rules. You don't have FDA studies. You don't run marketing ads for it. There are a number of factors. It has always been an inexpensive drug. The history of heroin. Heroin is actually a medication that was brought to the commercial market in the late 1800s. Brought as a pain reliever, a cough suppressant, and a medication that was actually used to help wean people off of morphine until we learned how dangerous it was, and the DEA regulated it as a Schedule 1, which is a medication considered with no medical application, a Schedule 1 controlled substance that has no legitimate purpose and no legal use in the United States. So the medication's been around for a long, long time, and it's easy to make.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe just a comment, and maybe you could comment on this. I'll try to form it in a question. In my neck of the woods, methamphetamine was a big deal, and the backlash was to regulate the way over-the-counter drugs came. And from my understanding, that was when the health effects of methamphetamine became well known. And from what I've heard from people who have been hooked, that going to heroin was less damaging. It was maybe not as cheap, but it was less damaging, but it was much more addictive. So, but that's what I heard. Is that something that you've heard as far as coming back to you, and maybe the doctor could...
Let me let Dr. Colescott address that.
If you take every drug per dose, per length of time taken, the most addictive is nicotine. Following that is heroin. Following that are the stimulants. Following that is alcohol. And following that is cannabis. So,
say that one more time.
Yes. Nicotine, first. Heroin, second. Third are the stimulants. That would be your methamphetamine, coke. Then alcohol, and then cannabis. And so methamphetamine is directly neurotoxic. To the brain, and there is no effective treatment at this point for methamphetamine dependence. With the opiates, however, it's not that they don't change the brain, they do, but there is effective treatment for it that are medications that can stabilize the brain while people are engaged in treatment.
Madam Chair, I can vouch for the nicotine one because I was 10 years hooked on nicotine, and so thank heavens it's been, you know, like 37 years, but that was probably the fight of my life.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. There you have it. Okay. Well, please, any further questions? Okay. So please continue.
No, thank you. Well, we've talked about it. I mean, there's no debate that regardless of the substance, there's a problem, and it is growing. And so there's a need for effective treatment. Treating alcoholism and any other addiction, I think the thing that this slide points out is no single treatment is appropriate for everyone. We need to match treatment settings, intervention, services. That means selecting the right psychosocial providers, the right medications to support these individuals, and putting them in the right settings is what's important. And I think the clinicians are going to talk a lot about how do you do a proper assessment and what are some of the challenges to identifying not just what treatment modalities are most appropriate, but where are they going to be delivered and where are the gaps in care in Alaska. We talk about recovery as a lifelong process. This is a chronic disease. There is absolute consensus among the medical community that addiction is a disease and not just a matter of someone having poor willpower. It needs to be addressed with both a combination of medical and psychosocial interventions. Family and peer support, wraparound services are critical, and is a process that is going to last someone their entire life.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cargill.
So I was slow to come to the disease part because in my thinking was this is not something you catch, and that was why I struggled with it. But it was no doubt in my mind that the effects of what they did or what you did became a real medical problem. And so when we go out in public and talk about it as a disease, that's the first reaction is you didn't catch that. And so I think there might be a predisposition, there might be different systems. So when you hear pushback from legislators, that's probably the drawing of the line is when did you get infected over when did you choose to become affected?
Interesting.
It's a good question and a good perspective. There's a number of evidence out there that shows that it may be a genetic predisposition. There's other evidence that once you've altered the neurotransmitter pathways significantly, dopamine is the one that's most indicated with our medication. That dopamine surge that comes with injecting or taking opiates or consuming alcohol is something then that your brain continues to crave, and no amount of willpower is generally able to overcome that because there's a genuine physical dependence that requires medical intervention and psychosocial intervention in order to treat. And that's the disease model. It's not an infectious disease. Not all diseases are infectious. People are born with genetic diseases. They didn't catch them necessarily. And so it's a different disease model than the infectious disease model, but it's a disease model nonetheless. And sometimes we even struggle with that, frankly, within the medical and pharmacy community of providers not remembering that there really is a treatment pathway here, and it's not just a matter of someone having poor willpower. Arguably, some people who are addicted made poor choices to get them to their places, but that doesn't negate the fact that it's a disease nonetheless.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to know how we hear things as well as how you hear things. And so because we hear about, for example, the measles, that's going to come your way, you know. And so how do you prevent that? And I can remember as a youngster people telling me, whether it was school or my parents, don't accept any white powder from anybody because you could get hooked, you know. And so but that wasn't catching a disease so much as being aware of what is out there that could really hook you. And so I just wanted you to hear how guys like me hear it anyway, that it could become a medical problem, no doubt in my mind about it. But it's just the difference between infectious diseases, for example, and how you deal with this.
Understood. Thank you.
Well, and part of the point of this, you know, presentation is learning to think about it that way. You know, I mean, how the disease model and integrating it into your Senate Bill 64,
right.
The cost of it and how it matters to the state. So,
to your point, there's a difference between abuse and addiction. There are people who abuse substances and never get addicted, and there are people who consume them and get addicted, and that's that's testimony that supports the disease model as well, that certain people are susceptible to addiction, and others, fortunately, are able to use substances recreationally and never become addicted. And we're not really clear on how to differentiate those two populations. This is a slide that talks about how the two different parts of the brain that this drug works on and that psychosocial support works on. So the limbic region of the brain is where your cravings come from, your primal drives. This is where your desire to eat, your pleasures, your rewards, the primal instincts we think about, fight or flight, comes from the limbic region. This is an area of the brain that is difficult to overcome. It is your instinct center. The cerebral cortex, however, is where your reasoning happens, your decision making. This is where you weigh the benefits, the positives and the negatives. And the problem, the way we define addiction, is someone who continues to use a substance despite full knowledge of the negative consequences. Someone who's addicted to heroin is not going to tell you, "I believe this is good for me." They know that there will be adverse consequences, yet they continue to use it nonetheless. That's your addict. And one of the problems with the limbic region of the brain is that it is such a powerful driver that it can override that cerebral cortex. It despite your best thinking, you're still going to drink that next drink, despite the fact you know you're an alcoholic, inject that next heroin, take that next morphine tablet, whatever it is. And so the remarkable thing about Vivitrol, as opposed to some of the other medication-assisted treatment programs, products, is that it works on that limbic region of the brain to normalize the neurotransmitters so that the cravings are dissipated when patients take opiates in particular. And by decreasing the cravings, you don't get that noise from the limbic region that's overpowering the cerebral cortex, and counseling tends to work better. And so the point to this slide is medication alone is not the answer. It's always got to be combined with counseling and psychosocial support. And so I don't want to get the impression that Vivitrol is the be-all, end-all. It's just one of the tools in the toolbox and needs to be supported with counseling.
Senator Costello.
Thank you. And what are the side effects of Vivitrol?
It's a good question. They're at the end of the presentation, but I can go over them now. But the most widely complained about medication, it's a big shot. It's an injection that lasts once. You get it once a month, so it lasts for 30 days. And it's 4 cc's of medication, which is a big shot. It goes in your bottom, and it hurts, at least for a couple days, because there's a lot of liquid and medication in that muscle. And soreness and reaction at the injection site is the most commonly reported side effect. Other side effects that we monitor for as healthcare providers are adverse effects on the liver. We also monitor for pneumonia in a small percentage of population of people. They'll get what's called eosinophilic pneumonia, which is a dangerous condition that would require treatment for pneumonia. But what we found is that people who get Vivitrol, less than 2% of them who receive Vivitrol ever have to drop out because of an adverse effect. People who drop out of Vivitrol programs tend to do it for a reason other than experiencing an adverse effect. Certainly allergic reactions and other things to the medication are possible, and we monitor for those as well. And there's a list of them that I can go over at the end of the presentation, because that's important to talk about what it does and what its side effects are.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the cost?
It depends on the treatment setting you go to. We work really hard as a company to keep the cost as low to zero as possible. People who have commercial insurance, most of the commercial plans pay for this medication. Our company provides a $500 copay assistance card, so if you have any sort of copay up to $500, our coupon will cover that. The medication itself to a commercial patient without insurance runs about $1,200 to $1,300 minus the $500 card, minus any insurance they have. Cost to state governments is much different. If it's a Medicaid recipient, the rebate that's associated, our company pays the state for people who fill it on Medicaid. The cost is around $600 to $700 to the state. Indigent populations, uninsured populations, there are programs that our company has to keep the cost of the medication down. So the simple answer to your question is between $600 and $1,300, depending on what kind of patient you are, what kind of insurance you bring to the table, and frankly, what kind of payer you are. If you're a state, you pay much less than commercial payers do.
Senator Wilkins.
Thank you. Is that $600 per month?
Yes,
okay.
Per shot.
And just if I could, it would, if there's some talk about expanding Medicaid, if their Medicaid were expanded, do you expect that this drug would be available for many more people in the state of Alaska?
I do. You have very good coverage under your Medicaid plan. Your Medicaid authority here recognizes the value of it. And one of the issues we'll talk about with some of the other presenters is the medication's only as good as the number of clinicians who are available to treat these patients and are able to care for them and do the medical assessment and write the prescriptions. And so we'll talk about that later on.
Excellent. Please continue. So we're on counseling now.
We're on counseling. I talked about this. Counseling is the foundation of care. And my presentation is probably the least interesting of them all, so I'm going to try to focus on the big picture issues and get the other people up here because I think you're really going to want to hear from them. I want to talk full balance about what agonists are and what antagonists are.
This is a good slide.
Okay. So there are three, when we're talking about opiate addiction, there are really three medications that we commonly use. Vivitrol is one, methadone is another, and buprenorphine, its brand name is Suboxone or Subutex,
yep,
is the third. This would be an example of treating opiate dependence with a full agonist like methadone. So what you're seeing there is what we call a mu receptor. It's a cartoon of a mu receptor. And what it shows there is a full opiate agonist like methadone or OxyContin or other full agonists that occupy that mu receptor. And what you see is the neurotransmitter surge, that dopamine surge, sort of like a lightning storm there, showing that that's one of the benefits. That is what the physical dependence has sought to crave. And by taking someone from uncontrolled recreational drugs to a drug like methadone, which is very controlled, safer environment, you've got nurses, physicians, and counselors monitoring it, full agonists are useful in certain populations of people that still need that dopamine surge in order to help them with their therapy. So that's one option. Second option are partial agonists. These are your buprenorphine type medications. They bind to the receptor as well. They bind actually very, very well to the receptor. The dopamine surge is less pronounced, so you don't see that big lightning storm, but there still is a stimulation of the dopamine reward system, that reward system that calms that limbic center of the brain down so that counseling and support will work. Again, all of these medications are really to help calm that limbic region of the brain down so that we can get to that cerebral cortex and have effective counseling. And then finally, there's a drug like Vivitrol, which is a full opiate antagonist. This doesn't completely stop the dopamine reward system, but it doesn't activate the dopamine reward system, so you have more normal levels of dopamine in your brain. And by normal, I mean similar to that of someone who's not addicted. One of the pushbacks I get on this slide is, you don't have any dopamine reward, and I don't want to say that at all. We haven't shut down the dopamine system, but we are fully occupying that receptor. One of the benefits to this drug is someone who wants to be completely abstinent, and that's important for whatever the treatment goals are. This medication will not occupy that receptor, will not activate the reward system, and actually will protect the brain from relapse. So if someone were to use an opiate medication during that 30-day period of time that Vivitrol is on board, they won't be able to stimulate that reward system. They won't get high, and it actually helps with treatment so that they're not overdosing. They're not in a dangerous place. And frankly, in some cases, let's say it's just a waste of time. I didn't get the desired effect that I wanted. And that's one of the benefits to the drug. So there are benefits to all three. And I wanted to talk about just how they work in a scientific way.
And on this point, would you say it's analogous to Wellbutrin and how it functions with respect to nicotine?
completely different mechanism of action.
And the only reason I say that is because for friends that I know that have tried to kick that habit, I haven't had that one, but they describe it as, they say, take Wellbutrin, and within 10 days you can keep smoking, but you no longer get the reward.
So in that sense, yes, I guess there's similar,
it's described as a complete,
similar type treatment programs, but I don't want to give the impression that the medications
bind
the same
to the neuro.
They may lead to the same therapeutic outcome, which is getting someone to treat their addiction, but the medications are not similar. Safety information. This is where we talked a little bit about the side effects. One of the benefits to the use of this drug when we're treating alcoholics is that it can be used in the outpatient setting, doesn't require detoxification. Patients just should not be actively drinking at the time of their initial administration. But it can be used early on. As soon as someone approaches a treatment provider and says, hey, if you and I agree, prescriber, patient, that this is a good medication for me, alcoholics can receive this medication fairly early in the treatment cycle. One of the barriers to getting opiate-dependent people on this medication, and why sometimes methadone and buprenorphine are better choices, is that our medication works so well at blocking that receptor that if there's any sort of opiate on board in the system, we're going to bump that medication off the receptor and put them into what's called precipitated withdrawal, which is a life-threatening condition that needs to be, usually people need to be hospitalized when they go into precipitated withdrawal. And I've got someone who runs a detox center in Fairbanks who's going to talk about how important it is to do detox and how few resources there are in the state. And that is one of the critical messages we want to bring home at the end of this meeting.
On that point, Senator Costello and I were kind of having a sidebar about when you do bump, if you will, and the question was, unhappiness or depression was sort of the discussion that we were having. And so I guess that on that same point, for alcoholics or those that are dependents on opiates, what does happen to people who are on Vivitrol and now it's in their system for 30 days and you've now locked up the neurotransmitter and you're not allowing for any of the binding to occur via the alcohol and via the opiate that might have been a dopamine transmitter? Are you worried about suicides? Are you worried about depression? What are some of the things that come in that way? And I guess maybe that's the counseling part of it.
Very, very good question. I'm going to have Dr. Colescott address that.
Okay. I've used both drugs. I have a lot of people on Vivitrol. I have people on Suboxone or Buprenorphine. And I'm familiar with the methadone clinic. I do physicals there. It depends.
Okay.
I use more of the Vivitrol with alcohol. But Paul Finch in Fairbanks uses more for his opiate people. When a person has been addicted to an opiate, and let's just talk about opiates, for a while, IV heroin or pills, they change the brain. Okay, they change the brain. And we're not dealing with normal brains. Okay, and if you simply took a person off of all opiates and then kept them for 90 days or so, what you would notice often is they would go through an acute phase of withdrawal, the sweats, the cramps, the diarrhea, the shakes, the irritability, lack of sleep, acute withdrawal. But after that, there are times when we call something PAWS, post-acute withdrawal syndrome, where for months they have no energy. Everything is sort of a gray. Nothing has color. They're not happy. It's hard to get motivated. They're dysregulated with their sleep. They're emotionally extremely labile. They don't react to stress well, and this can go on for months. And this is what, and in my experience, when I was worked at Clitheroe and there as the medical director there for 3 years, the opiate addict finds extremely intolerable. Okay, and finds it difficult. Now that can improve. That can improve if they can remain sober. But in this population, there's difficulty with that. you know, with that process. But it also is impacted by the fact that they have other pre-existing, you know, emotional problems. If they're pre-existingly PTSD, if they pre-existently have been raped or abused or they're homeless or they have bipolar disorder, these things are impacting this entire process as well. And there's a whole, there's a very high incidence of comorbid psychiatric problems in this population that we deal with. Very high. So it's not a cut and dry thing. There are some people that do extremely well on Vivitrol who have been opiate dependent. They're on it, they feel better, their mind is clearing, and that's true. There is a population that does not do well, whether or not they have a problem with alcohol or opiates. Okay. They have an underlying problem, and an underlying anxiety disorder, an underlying chronic severe depression that has really not been recognized or even diagnosed or not effectively treated because of their drug. So it's not that a person can't release their own dopamine, but they have to learn how to do that. And that's where your treatment team is so essential.
Got it.
Okay.
Great answer. Thank you.
What are the contraindications of this drug? People who are already receiving opiates, and we talked about that because they can go into life-threatening withdrawal. People who are already in withdrawal. We talk about the naloxone challenge test here. This is a test that some clinicians will use to help understand if there's any opiates on board. It's a small amount of a similar compound, not exactly the same. Our drug is naltrexone. Naloxone is a little different. And you'll hear about naloxone as a rescue drug. These are what the paramedics use to bring someone out of an acute overdose. Small amounts of naloxone can help understand whether or not there's opiates on board and can help prevent us from putting someone into precipitated withdrawal. And then people who are hypersensitivities, allergic reactions to the ingredients that we use to make our medication. What is Vivitrol? Once a month, extended-release injectable. It's administered by a healthcare professional. This is not something that you pick up at the pharmacy and self-inject. It's a complement to psychosocial treatment, and it's an opiate blocker. It's an antagonist. It is not a narcotic. It does not produce pleasure. It's not addictive. It's not associated with abuse. It's not a drug that's diverted. It doesn't have any street value that we're aware of. There's nothing that caused diversion, A, because it's administered in a healthcare provider office, and B, because it doesn't cause a high. We talked about how Vivitrol works. I'm gonna go through this a little bit more. Talked about precipitated withdrawal, vulnerability to opioid doses. This is important to talk about. When people have been on Vivitrol and stop taking Vivitrol and perhaps relapse, they're going to be more susceptible to overdose because they're naive. They don't have the same tolerance they had when they were addicted before treatment. And frankly, some of the street medications that they get tend to get more potent over time. And they may be taking what they thought was their old dose. They're not as tolerant to it, or they're getting a new version. And that's the hardest thing about buying street drugs. You don't know exactly what you're getting, and they can be very susceptible to opiate overdose. And so that's one of the things we work on. We keep them in treatment. The longer we can keep them into treatment, the better. We see more success. We talked about one of the side effects being injection site reactions. Efficacy. There's a lot of information in here about efficacy. You have this. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'm going to skip through this because I'd really like some of the other speakers to have a chance. And they'll be able to answer questions about efficacy as well.
Okay. I have two rounds. So you tell me who
three
you
rounds
want.
Should,
yes.
So.
Okay. There you go. So the next I have Rebecca Young with ANP and Wendy Smith, if you'd like them to go.
Yes.
And then the round after that I have Paul Finch and Lisa Reynolds.
Let's do that. If okay. I may, I know Dr. Colescott had some prepared remarks.
Great.
If you want to say a couple words, and then
sure.
We'll go to panel number two.
Okay. So, Senators, with your permission, I'm going to put in a nutshell, and Mark has already familiarized you with some of the chemistry that happens in the brain, but this is what I tell my clients briefly who come in, who are opiate dependent. You've changed the brain. Your brain, the brain is not normal at this point. How do I know that? You're withdrawing. you're tolerant. You are shooting up heroin, maybe 2 grams a day. That's a large amount of heroin. And it doesn't phase you. Actually, you feel better when you do it. And when you don't, you're miserable and can't function and are calling in work, you're missing work, you're not taking care of your family, you're ill, you're vomiting, you're losing weight, and or you're infected. You get skin infections from trying to find a vein, and you're in the hospital. These are not uncommon things that we hear. And so I tell them, the brain is covered, our little nerves are covered with all these receptors that receive the opiate and react to it. And once they do, when you start to do that repeatedly and with a large amount of drug, the receivers change. Their sensitivity changes, their numbers change, but not only that, once you stimulate that receiver, it creates a cascade within the entire nerve that affects the way the nerve functions down to the nucleus and how it expresses itself genetically. So this is a long-term change in the brain. How do we know it? Again, tolerance and withdrawal. Okay, and it's a relapsing course. It is a long-term deal. They one of the most incredible studies ever done was with civil commitments in California of about 900 and some IV heroin users. And I can provide you that graph. It's something I show my clients. They followed them for 40 years. And at the end of that 40 years, about 48% were dead. 12% they didn't know what happened to. 6% were still using. Some were intermittently using, and what that means to me in this field is that if they can't find heroin, they're doing coke or alcohol or something else. Less than 22% were able to remain sober. And that is still the stat with oral opiates. It's even probably less. Wow. So we're talking about a change that has been profound and is life-threatening with these people. There was so once you become that way, once you affect your brain that way, I look at my client and I say, now listen. And they look at me and they're thinking, dear God, what have I done? You know, it's a problem with memory as well. We remember things. And the brain knows, hey, I can release dopamine with this drug. And so when I'm depressed, angry, disappointed, worried, that survival area of the brain that isn't rational, by the way, is going to say, I need dopamine. Where am I going to get it? It's going to pull out your file and start with A. And it's going to work its way down to H, heroin, oxy. And it's going to tell you, get it. It's a matter of survival. It doesn't know, you know, what you're dealing with. It just senses the need for dopamine. And so this is the quandary these people are in. And so I tell them, I would do something with that opiate receptor. Different options. Could it be methadone? Sure. Could it be Vivitrol? Sure. Could it be buprenorphine? Sure. But I would do something with it. While you form a new network with the team that you're going to have to release dopamine, you have to learn how to do that again. And so I tell them two words you need to remember. You're in a marathon. This is no sprint, guys. It has affected the brain now. Yes, you made a decision. It wasn't smart. But now you've got a problem with the brain. So it's two, Senator. You know, and then, so think marathon and think team. You got to have a team that's going to help you navigate through this. How long? It's highly variable. But years. This isn't a six-month treatment thing. In my experience, it's years.
Thank you for that. And I love the way that you're explaining it. And this is the reason I wanted to have this. I bumped into these guys actually on an airplane, and we started chatting about this. And my father's a physician, so I come from a science background and firmly believe in counseling and the belief of God and all those things, but science. And I love this expression of find something to do with that neuroreceptor. Something else I would add to those listening, Angelina Jolie has a couple of great books out there. One of the great actresses out there that has been very open, like this gentleman to my left, about her addiction to heroin. and has written, she said it was the first great and still greatest love of her life, and said it would have killed her. And she said she dreams about it to this day, and talks about how she has handled it. And there are a couple of great books that we'll put on our website, you know, this discussion and some other things, and commend those to people that there are real people out there that deal with these things. And when you listed in order of importance nicotine and heroin and so on, that, you know, that people deal with these things every day. So, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. For the drug people in the community who are dependent on drugs to some degree, how receptive are they typically to treatment, number one? And number two, what obstacles are you seeing? What I guess we're legislators, what can we do if you think this is a good treatment, if the community thinks this is something we want to encourage people? How do we get people to take advantage of this?
That's a great question. I think people enter in treatment when they're backed up against a wall. Their husband's going to leave them. They're facing a divorce. Their children are being taken out by OCS. They're losing their job. Something's being compromised. Something salient. Remember, this center, that reward center, has to do with things that are salient, okay, important. And so when something salient is threatened, then they're willing to look. And then once they understand what they're dealing with, and understand it's a long haul, understand you won't do it alone. You would have done it. I mean, if you would have been able to. So once they understand what they're dealing with and willing to buy in, then I think they can move forward. And people do. The population I'm interested in, that I would propose that a pilot project for, are the women coming out of Highland. This is a very vulnerable population. Many of the women are there who are opiate dependent or alcoholics. They're detoxed. This is a population that you could give Vivitrol to. I would evaluate them. They're not withdrawing. Most of them have gone through withdrawal, or they have by the time they've been there for a while. This would be a population that is often open. They want to get out. They don't want to go back particularly. This is a population that you could make an intervention in. And it would be very interesting to see this done. There are other states doing it. And would it necessarily need to be with Vivitrol? It could be primarily, because this is a young population. If you're dealing with people with chronic pain, then I would do methadone. You have a good methadone clinic here in town. So there are different approaches, but that would be a population to target. And it would save you money. You could get these people engaged in local treatment programs. Even if, you know, at Breakthrough, it would be certainly cheaper than $55,000 a year that you're using to house these people. And it would be a way to integrate them back in a meaningful way. So it's a very high-risk population. That would be an interesting place to start.
The other place, too, is the expansion of the treatment and wellness courts. Mm-hmm. Or even as you deal with sanctions and sentencings for nonviolent drug offenses, offering mm-hmm. alternatives to treatment, not just to people who have access to the wellness and treatment courts, but to any municipal or state mm-hmm. court, county jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. That's been what a number of the states we've worked with in the past have looked at. Where are there opportunities to get people into treatment who are at the lowest point generally in their life when they're arrested or facing a judge, and what are the right populations to do that? And those are options that are out there. Build less jails and prisons and more treatment. It deals with the demand side rather than the supply side, and can be very effective. And you're seeing some of the states do that and have some just really fascinating and compelling mm-hmm. results. And mm-hmm. that we can share those with the committee and members and their staff as we learn of them.
Excellent. Thank you. Senator Wojcicki.
Two questions. Which states? I know you're going to provide some of that success.
Sure. But. Colorado, Missouri, mm-hmm. Ohio, Massachusetts, Maryland, California, Illinois. It's a number of states with a number of different legislative and administrative political makeups. Red states, blue states, doesn't matter. They've all been able to figure out some creative ways to do it. They usually start with pilot programs, places where it's easy, where the providers are already in place, where they can work out through the kinks in the system. small pilot projects, $250,000, $500,000 to get one or two projects started, and then replicate those as they go. The return on investment is very, very quick. You can see within 3 to 6 months whether or not your program's working, mm-hmm. whether or not you've got decreased recidivism. Colorado's program's special in that they're focused on parolees. These are people who they don't want back into the system for technical violations. And what they're seeing, and they did a pilot program last year, and they're continuing to expand that program this year, they're seeing a 45% reduction in recidivism for patients who've been treated with Vivitrol as opposed to parolees who weren't. And they're not administering the medication before they're released. They're administering it to them when they've got a technical violation. They come to their parole office. They've either missed a drug screen or had a dirty drug screen, and now they've got an option to enroll in the program instead of being violated on their parole. And the ones who are taking up the offer to start Vivitrol are doing very, very well. Mm-hmm. And Colorado is considering expanding that program and has dedicated mm-hmm. more resources. That's a very recent program.
I'm going to turn it to Senator Coghill, but a question is, what if you were to offer it to people prior to being released?
Mm-hmm. That's the best situation. As Dr. Colescott said, mm-hmm. these are people who are detoxed already because they've been incarcerated. One of the most vulnerable times for a person who's leaving jail or prison is the time between their release and the time they get to their treatment program, because they're back with the same people, places, and things that got them. They're making bad choices before. This is where they're going to be next. If we can get them a shot before they leave, and we're doing this in Massachusetts and Maryland in particular, we're giving them a shot before they leave, and literally we're buying them a 30-day window until we can get them to their next community-based mm-hmm. appointment, get them into the reentry program so that they can learn how to, rent an apartment, find a job, do all of these things. And if they do make a bad decision and they use, they're not susceptible to the same things that they would be without the medication.
Mm-hmm. That falls into the question that I was going to bring up, because the jails, as we move along, are going to have to get better and better at assessments, risk assessments. And this is going to be one area where I think we can zero in on. And then the other thing is the behavioral health issues within the jail just have not been risk assessed properly, in my view. And so in many ways, these programs will work in some areas and not in others. And so that's some of those tools. And so I would only say to those who are in this world, we need to encourage our Department of Corrections, who has a huge problem because they don't get to pick who comes in, on how to assess them. And I think your world can help them do that. And I'm sure they're looking in, but we need to know where we can put those best bangs to the buck. And so as we look at it, part of it is going to be how do we assess it, and then secondly, how do we administer it.
And I think those are things. Policy directory, it's elected officials and governor's staff and governors who are more than willing to share their experiences and help with how do you identify the low-hanging fruit that may already exist in your system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
So just going back a little bit, you talked about changes to the brain, right? So, and I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna or a Puritan of any type, but so currently in life, I get my dopamine from a good ski run, or my little girl comes running to the door when I get home or something, right? And folks that have a problem with drugs probably get less and less of that reward from life experiences and more of that reward from the drug that they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. It's been well known for a long time that the behavioral mechanism behind this kind of addiction is these people know how to modulate their affect and their mood. And so instead of developing normal coping mechanisms they have reverted to a drug to deal with distress of any kind. But also in this population, remember what they've been experienced to in modeling, especially the women at Highland. These are people that have been abused. These are people that have been raped. These are people that have never been nurtured appropriately. But on top of that, their new receptors their opiate receptors may not even be normal. There are some individuals that don't even respond to various opiate medications that we use for analgesia, and there may be an alteration in sensitivity of mu receptors that we are still looking into now. And so you're dealing with individuals that find a drug. They're not at home because there's nothing at home. They're beaten at home, or they're abused at home, or there's nobody at home. And so they're with a group of people that are bent on feeling good. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to find that stuff. And that was my horror when we passed, you know, this is an offshoot of marijuana now, because it's priming the brain. It's going to prime the brain in this very vulnerable population. But so, yes, you're right. They're going to revert to that. And you have a problem then. They'll be coming your way to Highland.
So I had a more of a
chicky.
So some people don't have that history yet, decide that injecting your fun might be something that's fun to try sometime.
Sure.
And
experiment.
They find themselves in that trap. When you talk about changes to the brain, even with treatment and medication, can they change their brain back, or are they there forever?
You know, it's really interesting when you read the data coming out of SAMHSA, the mothership of addiction, treatment recommendation, there isn't any endpoint. And we have people over at Breakthrough that have been on buprenorphine easy over 3 to 4 years. And I have one individual I'm thinking of now who looks at me and says, I'm not ready yet to come off of this. I would relapse if I did. You know, they'll tell you just point blank. And we have one individual who has bipolar, who's doing very well on Suboxone for years. We attempted to taper her, and her bipolar flared. So the mu receptor, the opiate receptor, is an interesting receptor. She is modulating her mood with it, plus her bipolar medications. So, it's not a cut and dried situation necessarily. So, the answer is, my own impression is that yes, this individual has had a change. Can you get off of the medication? I believe you can, but not without developing a very robust dopamine network and having a support system around you.
Senator Coghill.
It's been my experience that when they start at a young age in their teens, the forming of the brain is more highly impacted than if they started in their late 20s.
That's right. Oh, I don't know if you can change the nervous system back to normal again. I don't know. Or whether or not you just simply overlay it with other dopamine receivers, you know, releasers, and can manage it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? It's fascinating. Okay, well, so thank you very much, both of you, for and I want to say this to my committee, to our committee, that this isn't the last time that we'll hear from you. I'm opening this dialogue for a purpose. I was just thrilled, felt like it was destined, you know, that I heard from you guys, and want you to be resources for us. I want us to consider, I appreciated Senator Wilikowski's question. I love the Highland Mountain idea. I think it's great. There are other practical applications in Senate Bill 64 continuation. So we'll hear from you again. So don't feel like this is your last time to talk to us, but we'll move on to Rebecca Young and Wendy Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your time. And if you just state your name and your affiliation on the record for us. Thank you.
My name is Rebecca Young. I'm a nurse practitioner here in Juneau, and I work in several areas.
I work, my day starts out in Lemon Creek.
You move up to the microphone. Thank you.
A little bit closer there.
Appreciate that.
My day starts out at Lemon Creek. I'm contracted by Dr. Jim Thompson, who has the medical contract. He doesn't work for the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
He is a medical contractor for corrections. Here at Lemon Creek, the dental and the medical side is contracted out, and I work for Dr. Thompson there. After I leave corrections, I go to my family practice job, which is Valley Medical Care. And then on the weekends, I'm either in the ER at Bartlett or I'm with the National Guard. So in a course of a week, I see about 200 people, and I see a lot of opiate and alcohol addicted people. Do you want to tell me where you work?
Sure.
Then we'll go on.
My name is Wendy Smith. I'm a physician assistant, and I am a primary care provider in Juneau. I've worked in Juneau for 12 years. I only have one job and two small children and a husband and
cool.
a dog. But I work in primary care, mainly with internists, but I still do some adolescent care, and I'm the go-to for opiate abuse in our clinic. Mm-hmm. Well, someone's got to be an expert.
So I'm going to start just by answering some of the questions that were asked with the first round from my perspective. And I just want to say that my perspective is only my perspective. It's not the perspective of corrections. It's not the perspective of the ER or the National Guard or of Valley Medical Care. It's just my perspective and my experience.
And again, can you pull that just a little bit closer? I don't know if it'll go. Okay, good.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, so one of the questions was, how are Alaskans acquiring heroin?
Yes.
In Juneau, it mostly is muled in, so girls put it in their body and bring it in on the airplane. If they get picked up and arrested, they've brought it over a state line, they become a federal prisoner. And then I see them in Lemon Creek as a federal prisoner until they're picked up. Or I see them in the ER where I take the heroin out of their body. And it's mostly females. I have had some males that have put it in their rectum and brought it in. So that's usually how it comes in. I anticipate some does come up on the ferry system, but most of it that I see coming in the community seems to come in through the airlines. Okay? And they can mule in quite a bit in their body. So. All right, and then the next question is, why was heroin affordable? I don't know if any of you guys remember, but about 5 years ago, OxyContin was really big on the street, really expensive, and people became really addicted to it. When they didn't have the money or the resources for OxyContin, or it was a little bit low in the street, they went to heroin because it was more affordable. So when I know something's on the street or not on the street is when they're coming into my ER and they're dope sick, because they can't get their heroin and they can't get their street drugs. The clinics have gotten more savvy with their pain and their chronic pain patients with our drug seekers. If you were my 3 o'clock appointment today and you came in and you're a new client and you want to establish care and you have chronic pain, I have to make several phone calls to all the pharmacies to see if you're playing me against the pharmacies, against Wendy. Is Wendy prescribing medicine at family practice? Am I prescribing it at Valley Medical Care? So as a medical community, we've gotten much more attuned to this, and we have pain contracts and things in place to try to get some of the prescriptive drugs off the street.
And the drug monitoring program.
And the drug monitoring program at the state level. We don't have a very good piece in place to get the heroin off the streets and the way to monitor that.
Senator Costello.
Thank you, and you sound like a very busy person.
I am.
Are you familiar with the Medi-Set program, mm-hmm. where medications are delivered to the patient in a week-long package? I mean, it seems to me that having, you know, large volumes of these drugs out there that are part of people's prescriptions, you know, they're sitting in their homes and they're mm-hmm. they're just there, and we know that are ways for people to find out who has the drug in their home, but through a Medi-Set program, you would be delivering these drugs to individuals just with a weekly supply, and so it seems like it would reduce the opportunity for abuse. And I was curious, and if you don't know about the Medi-Set, then I
don't know about the Medi-Set program, but I know about prescribing. So some of the insurances will pay for a 30-day supply, so you can only get your prescription written once. So I can't write you a short term because you can only get a month's supply. And if that month's supply is a week's worth, they can only get one prescription. So there are some drawbacks to that. There's plenty of ways for people to, with the drugs in the community. Interestingly enough, several years ago, my house was robbed. And it was this young lady actually is in Highland. It was a a little group of women that were coming around during the day ringing the doorbells, and when you'd answer the door, they would say, "Is Sally home?" And they'd say, "I'm sorry, you know, Sally lives here." If you didn't if nobody answered the door, they would just come in the house, and then they would take medicine out of the medicine cabinets. This was very prevalent for a while in the community, so that's how they got it. It wasn't that they knew a person had a large volume. They were quite happy with the 15 that were left over from your ankle fracture or anything. So they're very creative on how they would get their prescription pills on the street. One of the things that I think is real important, and I've listened to everybody talk, is to identify who is that heroin addict that's out there. We have this preconceived conception that it's this person sitting between a building tweaking or shaking. It's not. So as I was listening, I wrote down a few of people that I've treated over the years. They've worked in our banks. They've worked at our post office. They're your hairdresser. They're the state employees. They're your road crews. They're the people that work on the electric lines, and they're your high schoolers. They're not that person that's down and out. They're like the people right beside you. Maybe not me. but they are. And people need to realize that anybody can be addicted to alcohol or opiates, and we don't know who they are. They might be the person loaning the money for your house, for your mortgage, and you wouldn't know that. So,
quick question.
Yes.
Madam Chair, just when you talked about those cross-checks that you do with mm-hmm. other pharmacies, mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people talk about that, but what are the results? I mean, are you finding mm-hmm. that people are playing the system fairly regularly, and
right.
what do you then do when you determine that that's the case?
Well, if I'm usually am seeing them in clinic, I just go out and make a few phone calls or look in some systems, and if they've gotten medicine, then I just go in and tell them, "Well, you didn't tell me you were just in the ER and you got a prepack of 5 Vicodin, you know, so therefore, you know, I'm not comfortable prescribing to you," and stuff. And I'm just honest, and they do respond to honesty. They don't like it, and once in a while they're violent, but they will respond to honesty.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Are the treatment centers that we have in Alaska adequate enough to treat the numbers of people that we have with this problem?
I'm not familiar with all the treatment centers in Alaska. I know Juneau doesn't have a lot of options. So if you're going through acute alcohol or drug withdrawal, that's withdrawal, not intoxicated or coming off the drugs. You have to be in active withdrawal. You can come into the ER, and we can try to get you a bed on mental health if their bed is available. If you have a medical issue, like I have seizures when I withdraw, we'll have to get you a medicine bed in the same hospital, and then hopefully get you into Rainforest recovery. You can sign yourself into Rainforest with a $50 deposit, which a lot of our addicts don't have. And in Juneau, that's basically it. There's some outpatient counselors that do it and stuff. There's Bill Brady in Sitka. Raven's Way used to be over in Sitka, but most of them, they have a hard time finding treatment centers. And most of the people I see go to treatment go from corrections. I see them in corrections. They come to see me in sick call because they need a physical to get into recovery because it's going to shorten their term or their sentence.
So the answer is?
No, we don't have enough. I would suspect in the whole state.
Or you can't afford to go.
They're expensive. Families will take a second mortgage on their home to send their kids to detox.
Senator Wilkins.
If people are on Medicaid, does that cover their treatment?
I know there are some resources within it depending on their age. So I don't know of any adults that have used Medicaid for treatment, but
remember, Medicaid is state specific, so they have to go to a state facility, Alaska facility. There's very few facilities for children being under the age of 18 in Alaska for treatment. And so if they're Medicaid or Denali Kid Care, they have to stay in the Alaska system. Providence, I think, will take a couple inpatient, and one of our speakers actually has the detox center in Fairbanks and may have more knowledge on that than myself.
Okay. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
Okay.
Well, from my standpoint, I see barriers to care as access to providers that can or are willing to see people for substance abuse. So
as the only one in my clinic who's willing to take the time and energy to deal with no-shows or late patients or non-payers or, I mean, all the barriers that come with substance abusers, it's difficult for them to find someone that will even see them to treat their depression or their withdrawal or their relapse. They've been good for 6 months. So I find that as very disturbing, and it's, I'm not sure how to fix that. You know, we talked about more treatment facilities instead of more prisons, but as a provider, I feel kind of pressured to see, I don't have enough time to see them all. Not that I'm having a flood of opiate addicts or alcoholics, but it is time-consuming, and so that I find is a barrier, too, that providers are unwilling to see patients, even in my own clinic. So I don't know how you feel in yours, but
at Valley Medical Care, myself and another nurse practitioner see the bulk of all the heroin, I call them my heroin kids. They're not all kids, but my heroin addicts and alcoholics. And I have a large following of them there. Now, mm-hmm. granted, I probably get some that see me because they've seen me in the ER, they've seen me in corrections, and they'll mm-hmm. follow through with me and see me there. But nobody, they're not a, it's not a patient that you really want. And if you see them on your schedule, you roll your eyes,
yeah.
you know,
take
unfortunately
breath.
Is too bad, because it's not that person with uncontrolled diabetes that's morbidly obese that eats whatever they want. Those people don't have a hard time getting a provider, even though they're very non-compliant, just like your heroin addict.
Interesting.
But they don't have a hard time getting seen. But the heroin addict has a hard time getting seen because they get that label that comes with them.
What is the difference in that they're both diseases? How would you describe the difference societally from the healthcare community?
I think it's just a stigma that these people that are addicts get, you know, because unless you have a personal and became personally involved with it, or you're more open to it, you have this idea that they're going to lie to you. Like, why would you think that somebody would lie to you? But it's a very common perception that people believe that people that use or abuse heroin may lie to you. People would believe they might lie to you just to get you to help them. They commonly do, but my diabetics lie to me all the time. My breastfeeding mothers lie to me about how much they're breastfeeding. You know, people, you know, but they don't get the same stigma that your heroin people will get. So
the two of you as providers, if you could leave us with a few thoughts as policymakers that you think we could, you know, that we should know.
Every heroin user should have health insurance, period.
Okay. Okay.
That's what I want. Then there's no barriers, because it's all, I can't afford to come. I'm like, I don't even charge you people. No charge, half of you. So just come. I will help you.
So Senator Machiki said, would you repeat that?
Can you repeat that?
I wish that all heroin abusers had health insurance so that wasn't a barrier to their care, because they don't want to come to the doctor to have another bill to get treatment, and it could just be an excuse. But finances is a big deal, even though I try to make it as reasonable as possible.
Okay.
So
Senator Machiki?
This is big, right?
Yeah.
So
I mean, and how do we fix that problem?
We talk about some of the reasons people become addicts, and a lot of it is from early abuse in life. We talk about some of the folks that just, I mean, I can understand the difference between someone who is type 1 diabetes and someone who chooses to become an addict later in life, separating it from someone who suffered from abuse or some sort of other horrible upbringing. But, I mean, we almost need to bring law enforcement in here on understanding how we could be better at intersecting the supply of drugs and understanding treatment options. I mean, it's big. It's a big problem. It's growing. I mean, in our community, we have a lot of recent crime, which is why I was interested in the cost being lower of heroin, because we have a lot of recent crime related to just property crimes. I mean, they're not violent crimes. They're related to raising more money for drugs. I mean, I don't know how you get started. And is treatment the option? What can we do better about getting in front of it so that people that have some of those behavioral challenges because of abuse and other things just don't begin in the first place? Certainly it has to be easier than treatment or incarceration, right?
I had one patient tell me that he would abuse anything, so it didn't matter what was there, what was in the medicine cabinet, or, I mean, he would use anything. So I don't know that getting rid of drugs is going to help, but trying to make people choose not to use them is important. You know, why don't I use drugs? Why don't you use drugs? Because I'm scared of them. Why aren't you scared of them? I don't understand why people aren't scared of heroin, and they just aren't. Right. I ask my, why don't you think this is going to make your heart explode every time you shoot it into your veins? I don't know.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. Well, thank both of you. We're getting close. We've got about 15 minutes roughly left. I want to hear from, thank you both. I want to hear from Paul Finch and Lisa Reynolds. And Lisa, if you guys would both come forward. Lisa, are you here in the room? Yes. And Lisa, I want to hear from you first. I think, you know, a lot of what Senator Michicki and others have been talking about, you know, your story is very compelling. It's a story that goes to the heart of, I think, what we're all struggling with. You know, first of all, every one of us here on your panel is a parent. Actually, one of us here is a grandparent already. But all of us here are parents, so I say that to you. We're all Alaskan parents, and so we share that with you today. And we, in addition to being parents, I think all of us would say we're motivated to serve in large part by being parents, and we're here to try to make Alaska a better place, and but these problems are so complex. And the mental health problems, you know, I see Jeff Jesse here, and I thank him for all that he does for us in the state. You know, I've often said my brother has a traumatic brain injury, and it was acquired when he was a teenager from a car accident. But I've said, you know, when you see somebody with a cast on their arm, we all get it, or they're in a wheelchair, and we all open the door for them, and we all sort of move mountains for them. But when someone has a brain affliction, whether it's a disease of addiction or whether it's a traumatic brain injury, none of us see it, and we don't necessarily understand it, and there's stigma associated, and we don't know how to help them always. And so as a society, we grapple with these issues, and John and I have served together almost as long. He served a little longer than me, but about 15 years together. We've been on and off the Judiciary Committee together, and struggling with how to help people with mental health issues. And so we are interested in hearing the story of your child who suffered from addiction, and I hope it helps us to form a backdrop in thinking about relapse and what we can do today. For those who are joining us, we're looking at the idea of how actual medicine can help, and the science of medicine and binding to neuroreceptors can help with counseling and other things. And so I thank you for being here today. If you'd put your name on the record and tell us your story.
My name is Lisa Reynolds, and thank you very much for allowing me to be here to speak today. I'm just going to read this and try to get through it and not cry. So I'm a lifelong Alaskan, been here 54 years tomorrow. I'm not a doctor, nor a therapist, or a counselor. I'm a concerned mom like so many others here in Alaska who have struggled to find help for their loved ones here in the state. I'm here today telling my story in hopes that we'll be able to get funding for much-needed treatment facilities, recovery facilities, medical treatment, and sober living. These are all things that I have struggled with, and so many people that I know that have struggled with here in the state of Alaska. My 20-year-old son is a drug addict and an alcoholic. 2 years ago, I discovered this when he moved back home. Little did I know at the time, this is the beginning of a long, difficult, agonizing journey for our family. I spent days and countless hours desperately trying to find interventionists, inpatient rehab programs, recovery program, medical treatment, and sober housing for my son. Because of the lack of programs and facilities here in Alaska, I had to get an interventionist from Washington, which is very expensive. I had no other alternative because there was nobody else qualified here to do it. I knew this was the only way I would be able to get my son to go to rehab to get the help that he needed. Interventions don't always work, but this guy was good. And by the grace of God, we were able to convince him to get my son 2,000 miles away to rehab in Utah. Far away from all of his family and support, we knew no one there, and I just prayed I found the right place and that he would get the care he so desperately needed. It turns out the facility was top-notch, and thankfully they took my son on just insurance and no cost up front. If I had to pay thousands of dollars up front, I don't know what I would have done. I didn't have the money. My son was in rehab in Utah for 92 days the first time, during which time I traveled there practically every other week to attend family group therapy and counseling for my son. I'm a flight attendant for Alaska Airlines, so I was fortunate I could do that. They nicknamed me Mama Bear from Alaska and couldn't believe I had traveled all the way from Alaska to support my son in his treatment. When my son came home 92 days later from rehab, he didn't get the medical treatment that he should have gotten, and he relapsed shortly thereafter. Then by the grace of God again, I once again got him back there, this time for 30 days. Upon his return to Alaska, he struggled to find a medical doctor to help him with his medical treatment. Then you need to assist him in his recovery, along with the counseling and NA meetings and all these things that you have to put in place along with the medical treatment. Having to send my son out of state put great hardship on my family. It not only cost us thousands of dollars in loss of work using my FMLA, sick leave, hotels, rental cars, it cost us emotionally. You see, the whole family needs to participate in this in order to make this successful for the addict. Several weeks later, my son relapsed again. This time I found a detox facility in Fairbanks called Gateway. This is my hero here. I was so grateful to have found one so close to home, but we had to wait 3 days before a bed was available. They only have 2 beds there for opiate addicts. We had to call every day to stay on the list, not to lose our place for that bed. And when the addict relapses, time is crucial. You don't have 3 days. You don't have a day. You have to move quickly. I was able to get him there. Before he left Gateway, he got the medication that he needed to help him with his sobriety. He got a Vivitrol shot, and he also got Neurontin, which is a medication to help him with his anxiety. This saved my son from relapse on returning home. It literally saved him. It has been a crucial part of his sobriety, along with counseling and meetings. My son is doing well today and working 2 jobs. I haven't seen him this clear-minded in years. We take it 1 day at a time. That's something that you learn when you have an addict, because it's just 1 day at a time. We're now struggling to find him sober living in Anchorage, where he can be close to family. That is a nightmare in itself. Drugs are still making their way into these facilities, these sober living facilities. My son needs a safe, sober living environment to recover. It's another service that we need in Roadblock. It's astonishing to me that we are so lacking the resources to assist those with drug addiction and alcoholism for those living in Alaska. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health that provides national state-level data on the use of alcohol, illicit drugs, mental health in the United States rank Alaska as one of the 10 highest among all the states. Yet we have no facilities or programs here here in our state. I share my story with others only to find that so many have loved ones who are dealing with the same struggles. They, too, are searching for help in Alaska and have some frustrations and difficulties as I have had. Addicts and alcoholics can get better and live happy, healthy, sober lives, but they just can't do it alone. They need programs, medical treatment in place to assist them on this difficult road. It needs to be safe, responsible medical treatment. I do not want my son on methadone, which is a synthetic opiate, or Suboxone, which is addictive as well. He doesn't need any more substances to be addicted to. That's my opinion. Alcoholism and addiction touches someone or someone we love, a family member. It's epidemic in America, and we have a huge problem in our state. It probably has touched a loved one of yours. I hope this story will help facilitate getting our state the funding, the programs, the medical treatment that we so desperately need to help those in this great state of Alaska. I love my son with all my heart. I won't give up supporting him in his sobriety. He's an incredible young man. He is so smart. He is so strong. He's kind. He's loving. He's caring. He wants to be clean and sober and struggles every minute of every day. My son is not a bad person. He is not a criminal. He has a disease and a mental illness. My son was predisposed genetically to become an alcoholic and addict. He had it on both sides of his family. He was 98% chance of becoming an addict. He didn't choose this. He needs help like thousands of others, and it's our responsibility, our obligation to help those who suffer from addiction and alcoholism. We can't be ashamed of it, but we rather to talk about it like we're doing here today. I'm so glad that we're being able to talk about this today and to get the resources that they need. I asked several friends and family members that have addict loved ones or lost their loved ones to addiction and alcoholism to write letters today, but so many said it was just too painful to write. It touches the deepest part of one's heart and soul to see suffering to the ones you love with your whole being. The problem can no longer be ignored. I'm asking all of you to think long and hard about the task before you. It is an important one. It's a matter between life and death for many. For my son. I believe it's one of the most important tasks that you'll have before you. Thank you so much for your attention, your consideration, and your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Well said.
Okay, Paul, thank you. You've got one of the few clinics in our state. Well, tell us a little bit about it and what we can do to support you.
1 minute.
Oh, you've got more than that. We'll take a little bit. We'll go. Is it okay if we go a little bit over, guys?
Or we could reschedule. A
few minutes.
For Paul, sure.
We'll let you go over. You're worth it.
Well, it's good to hear from Lisa, and I don't have a release, so I can't confirm or deny I know anybody she's ever related to.
Of course.
But it is heartwarming to hear how things are going for her. My name is Paul Finch. I'm a PA, and I work at Gateway Detox in Fairbanks, and I also do some care at Turning Point Counseling there in Fairbanks. It's an outpatient setting. So basically what I do is I do detox and then do medication-assisted treatment. So I think that's one of the biggest issues in the state is getting people off of it. That's one of the biggest barriers to treatment is fear of withdrawal. And if we can somehow harness the providers we do have, even family practice folks in an outpatient setting. I do it outpatient. It can be done for some people in an outpatient setting. It's not a hard, it can get a little rocky, but it's not really, really hard to do. And I think over time, it should be mainstream in family practice, the approach. And I appreciated the comments about not discriminating against our peeps, our folks.
How many patients can you see at Turning Point and Gateway? So are Turning Point's counseling and Gateway to Recovery the same?
No. Okay. Gateway is the inpatient facility administrated by Fairbanks Native Association.
Okay.
And it's a 16-bed facility, but only two of them are designated to opiates.
Okay.
We do alcohol folks there, too. So commonly we're pretty busy with alcohol. And then the opiate folks, they're there for 1 week for short-acting opioids and 2 weeks for long-acting. We can get them off of a Suboxone and methadone. So it's just a longer time. It's a little more rocky, and we just don't have the staffing or resources to take more at this time. But those beds are commonly just full all the time. There's a waiting list. People call back, as you heard, and we could do more if we had more resources.
Is there anything the state could do to help you to that end? What are the challenges to creating more beds?
I can't speak for the entity. Okay. I think that would be a discussion between the powers that be and FNA leadership about developing maybe even a different facility or more programs or something. And I you know, just as an idea, I'm thinking that maybe we shouldn't always look to the state or the government to fix this. There is a whole private sector, you know, and maybe it could be entertained to attract like Hazelden or a leader in the industry to come and establish a state-of-the-art facility in Alaska. It's a business. It's billable.
Absolutely.
So,
well, given the rates that have been discussed that you referred to, I mean, it's alarming. And then the challenges that we have, knowing how many families it sounds like have to go out of state.
Yes.
That would seem like it.
But there are the folks that don't have the paying capacity, and if people had insurance, then they could access a private sector situation. Turning Point is the business model is fee for service, and it is private, and it's expensive, but it's good. And I can see if 2 to 4 people a week, but because that's fairly intense, I don't have a nurse. It's almost a moonlighting job, and I follow them, and that we do good business over there for those who can do the outpatient detox part. So,
any questions? Well, thank you very much to everyone for being here today, and we look forward to communicating with you in the future. Thank you for your heartwarming story, and I mean, I think that the clear takeaway is there's promise with Vivitrol and some of the chemical treatments. There aren't enough resources. There isn't enough treatment, and there's too much addiction. So thank you very much, and we're adjourned.
Thank you.